docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050169, Farmers Group, Inc., et al., versus Jan Lubin, Gilbert Villanueva, and Michael Palladino from Travis County and the Third Court of Appeals District. Justice Willett is not sitting in that cause, and in both causes, Justice Harriet O'Neill is sitting but could not be present for argument. And docket number 060868, National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, versus Beatrice Crocker, which is here on certified questions from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. In each case, the court has allotted 20 minutes per side, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050169, Farmers Group versus Jan Lubin and others.
May it please the court, Mr. David Maddox will present argument for the petitioners. The petitioners have reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The legislature empowered the Commissioner of Insurance to enforce consumer protection laws, against insurance companies through a variety of measures, including providing that a class action could be filed to recover damages for policyholders caused by insurers' deceptive or unfair acts. This grant of authority did not, as the interveners argued and the Court of Appeals decided, turn the Attorney General, the state's chief legal officer, into a private class action lawyer. Rather, it authorized the use of a class action procedure to further the goals of the legislature to make the insurance marketplace free from fraudulent and deceptive practices and to provide compensation to policyholders not available at common law. The content and structure of HB 417 and simple logic demonstrate the legislature intended that the Attorney General prosecute a class action for unfair or deceptive trade practices as the chief legal officer of the state of Texas, not as a private class action lawyer required to solicit a private citizen to serve as a class representative. First, HB 417 shows the legislature created a consumer protection statute that included four separate types of causes of action distinct from, in addition to,
how do you get into this parent try argument when, as I understand it, nowhere in the statutes is this term is ever mentioned, and you want to proceed under this theory? So how does that work into your argument?
With respect to the parents patriae, putting it in historical context, what had happened is you had cases like Hawaii and Frito-Lay, which had indicated that
The U.S. Supreme Court held differently in the Hawaii case than the theory you're trying to push forward here.
What the court held there was, it said, without a legislative grant of authority for a cause of action for damages, then a case couldn't be brought for a cause of action for damages. And it's our position that Section 17 provides that.
But they treated a class action as different from parens patriae.
True, they did, but the question revolves around whether or not there was a statutory grant of authority such as there is here in Section 17. What Section 17 does is empowers the Attorney General to recover damages.
I understand that argument. I'm just confused. I'm like Judge Medina. I'm nervous about any legal doctrine I can't pronounce. What does parens patriae add? Why do you need it? Why'd you bring it in? It's not in the statute. What are you trying to do with it?
Well, I think what that is trying to focus the court's attention on is what was the legislature trying to create? Was it trying to create a situation, like the Court of Appeals said, which merely authorized the Attorney General to act like a private lawyer? And it's our position that certainly wasn't what the legislature intended.
So are you asserting a parens patriae action? Are you using it just as an adjective to describe what you think an Attorney General class action is?
I think the answer to that is both, because we're bringing a Section 17 of the Insurance Code class action that was authorized by the legislature, that the Commissioner of Insurance, as part of his regulatory array of things he could do, including an administrative class action he could do himself, or he could ask the Attorney General to bring a class action.
I understand all that.
Right.
You know, I wonder, why, what does parens patriae add?
Well, I think what it adds is, in putting it in historical context, the concept that it's the Attorney General who is bringing the class action. It's the Attorney General who is representing the interests of the policyholders. And one does not, therefore, need an individual policyholder to serve as an individual person instead.
So who does the defendant insurance company depose?
Well, the first, what would happen is the Commissioner of Insurance would determine that there was a violation of the insurance code provisions. These are statutory provisions, not common law. So with respect to the claim, the cause of action, it would be they would depose the investigators, they would depose whatever complainants had done, the Department of Insurance had found with respect to what the underlying claims were.
But that's the, I mean, if you're going to depose policyholders, that's just the same as having a named class representative, isn't it?
No, I would disagree. In this case, the legislature had indicated that the cause of action would be brought at the instance of the Commissioner of Insurance, not at the instance of a private policyholder. And that's the fundamental distinction we're talking about. Clearly, as a matter of fact, what the question is going to be is, did this insurance company and its practices, whatever that insurance practice may be, violate a statutory prohibition? And can the Commissioner of Insurance, therefore, sanction that insurance company? And part of that sanction is either administrative class action, it could be fines, it could be simply orders to change business, cease and desist orders, or it could be an action to make sure that policyholders are made whole through a class action.
It couldn't be emotional anguish.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, it couldn't be any kind of emotional anguish. I mean, the interveners, if they want to bring a class action that includes emotional anguish, assuming you can get such a class certified, without any named representative, you couldn't make such a claim. The commissioner couldn't make such a claim.
Well, I think that the commissioner, if I understand the court's question correctly, the commissioner is making the determination that an insurance company violated the insurance code. And that determination then would have to be adjudicated in a court. What a private class action would do is basically act in the stead, and this sort of goes back to the historical nature of class actions, is when an individual wants to enforce a state law as opposed to a common law right of action, then they're acting as, in effect, a private attorney general. And in this case, the legislature didn't have to grant that private attorney general status. It could have simply made this a regulatory statute and then provide Section 14, which is the administrative class action, Section 15, which is the attorney general action. But it also provided Section 16, an action for damages. And then through 17, it allowed for what I would, if the court will, a public class action brought by the Commissioner of Insurance and prosecuted by the Attorney General, and a private class action. And in that stead, what is happening is the individual plaintiff is acting as a private Attorney General. And what the Court of Appeals has done is sort of turned that on its head. And you start with the notion that the legislature can authorize an individual citizen to act as a private attorney general, and the Court of Appeals has said, in this case, the real attorney general has to act like a private citizen.
I'm unclear whether you think the preponderance, superiority, notice, and other provisions of the statute apply to a class action brought by the attorney general.
Well, I think that in the nature of the, I think to the answer to your question is, The statute can be interpreted in two ways. The first interpretation would be that if you look at the express language of 18A, then that applies to individual persons because it talks about a representative member of the group. If you look at 18B, then the question becomes, does that apply to the Attorney General, or because it references back to 18A that it doesn't? I think in these types of cases, we have to recognize there are statutorily created causes of action. The insurance company determines if there is a violation of the insurance code. And by that very nature, that type of a claim is going to be not a unique claim. It's going to be a claim that applies to everyone who has an insurance policy with that insurance company. Either the insurance company violated a provision of the insurance code, or it didn't violate a provision of the insurance code. If it did, then I think those two factors will in fact be met. So I think that in looking at that section, the court can conclude it's not necessary in the Attorney General class action context, because once the Commissioner of Insurance has made the determination that a violation occurs, and then once a court makes that same determination, that those are the allegations, and in effect, 18D is met. So I think, and
there's an argument that in cases that the class action has a barring, a preclusive effect on other claims, race judicata or collateral estoppel. How do you think that plays into an action brought by the Attorney General?
Well, I think that in the context of this statute, we need to go back to Section 14 as well, which is administrative class action, where the Commissioner of Insurance can make a determination that a sanctionable offense has occurred and then order a refund of premiums. And that, in effect, would have that same preclusive effect. And again, in fact, in Section 17, it says if the Commissioner of Insurance has brought such an administrative class action, then another procedure, a class action procedure in 17 can't be followed. But I think the reality is that, yes, if in fact the court determines in a settlement or in a trial that a violation of the code occurred and that compensation should be provided to the policyholders, and that would have res judicata effect. I think that's the intent of the statute. And in this particular situation, by the legislature granting the Attorney General these various arrows in the quiver and the Commissioner of Insurance's various arrows in the quiver, the intent of that was primarily, as the Attorney General Hill, who brought the bill to the House, said, was to empower the Attorney General to take care of insurance practices that could not be addressed at common law. And in so doing, the legislature created a regulatory structure allowing the Commissioner of Insurance to make that determination and then, if necessary, to provide compensation to policyholders. And what
What would prevent if, of course, 2121's every time anybody has an insurance question or dispute, they throw in a 2121 claim. What would prevent in a single homeowner thinking I didn't get my claim paid fast enough, what would prevent the Attorney General, if you don't have to meet the 18A requirements, what would prevent the Attorney General from filing a class action against an insurance company because they didn't pay one policyholder fast enough?
Well, with respect to that type of a claim where it was an individualized claim, then it would not be a situation where the Commissioner of Insurance had determined that that was a rating practice violation. In other words, it has to be a violation of under 2121, one of the specific statutes. And so the Commissioner of Insurance...
individual policyholders all the time, in almost every fight with their insurer, say you violated 2121, you committed an unfair settlement practice or an unfair insurance practice. What would prevent the Attorney General picking and choosing 1,000 independent cases around the country, all having nothing to do with one another, and filing a class action by the Attorney General one case at a time?
Well, I think the answer to that lies in the structure of the statute, which is the Attorney General brings the class action after the Commissioner of Insurance has made the determination that a rating practice violates the code.
So you say, well, you know, the check on the Attorney General to the Commissioner of the Insurance. But, I mean, what does the... suppose it's the Commissioner of Insurance that wants to get, you know, make insurers pay. And so he's got a few friends here and there and decide he refers all these cases to the Attorney General. You're basically saying you could have a class action of one.
Well, I think that ultimately you will have a court involved in this situation.
I'm the judge and I don't want the Attorney General messing up my simple contract dispute. Under your theory, how do I kick you out if 18A is not required?
Well, I don't think the statute applies to simple contract disputes. It applies to violations of the procedures for deceptive and unfair trade practices.
You're new to insurance. You're new to civil practice of insurance disputes, aren't you? Because every insurance policy dispute has an unfair, they claim it, everyone, 100%.
I understand individual citizens do that.
So I want to know how the Attorney General gets involved in all these cases. How do I, trial judge, toss you out? Because this isn't a class action. It's, as you're trying to tell me, a simple insurance dispute, and maybe a subsequent Attorney General says, yeah, but it's an Attorney General class action.
Well, I think that under 18D, Section 18D, the trial court has the authority to make a determination if the class action is appropriate. And in the circumstance you've described, I think the trial court would have the authority to say, I'm not going to proceed on a class action.
Well, counsel, you're sharing time. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, your time has expired, and I mean, you, Justice Brewster, you may.
No, that's, I've tried four times.
May it please the court, Mr. Russell Post will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court,
Mr. Post.
Yes, sir.
Before you get into argument, this is actually a question I wanted to ask the other side. So we're talking about an historical context when we were asking about this parens parent tribe doctrine. As I understand it, it's been historically used for quasi-sovereign interest. What would be the state's quasi-sovereign interest in this matter? And my notes also indicate that it's also been used for injunctive and equitable relief. So how does that doctrine apply to this situation,
Your Honor,
if it does at all?
The answer principally is that it doesn't apply here. The parens patriae doctrine is historically used for injunctive and equitable relief to enforce the state's interests as the sovereign. And the Supreme Court has made it plain that if the state is asserting the individual claims of particular citizens, that is not within the scope of what is known as quasi-sovereign interests, which are the classic test for parens patriae standing. Now, the state obviously has an appropriate police power interest in enforcing its laws, and that is classic parens patriae authority to bring injunctive actions to regulate enforcement of the law, and that is what Section 15 of this statute authorizes the Attorney General to do. What it does not authorize him to do is to act as a parent patriae and to bring and release the damage claims of individual citizens. That would go a step beyond what parents patriae doctrine has historically been understood to do. And in answer to the questions that the court has asked as to where the parents patriae doctrine fits here in the face of a statute that makes no reference to parents patriae on its face, the answer is that the petitioners are trying to use the philosophy of parens patriae to rewrite a statute that says the Attorney General is authorized to bring a class action because they have not complied with the basic requirements for a class action.
Can they?
Can they? Yes, Your Honor, they could, because the Attorney General is authorized through Section 17 and Section 18 to bring class action, provided he represents a class representative.
But how can he do that?
Well, there are two areas in which he could do that. First, Your Honor, there are political subdivisions of the state which have to take insurance and which could have proprietary standing to assert these claims. They could be brought forward as potential class representatives. Second, the witnesses for the state testified at the class certification hearing, and I quote, "The Commissioner of Insurance has received thousands and thousands and thousands of complaints about these practices." That's at Volume 2 of the reporter's record at page 77. All of those claimants would be potential class representatives.
Yeah, but he can't represent.
I think that's not correct, Your Honor. I think that the better reading of Section 17 and 18 that harmonizes all the provisions of the statute is that the Attorney General is authorized to represent a class representative in this context. That's what the legislature means when it says you may bring a class action, and then Section 18B says a class action is maintained by an individual member of the class.
So the Attorney General becomes a private lawyer, in effect, under this statute?
Your Honor, the Attorney General becomes the lawyer for the state, as he always is, but he becomes the lawyer that in this instance is authorized to represent a class representative with standing to bring the claims that are adequate and typical.
Can the class representative fire him?
Can the class representative fire him? The class representative can terminate the attorney-client relationship, and in that instance, if he has another class representative, then he can come forward again. Now, Justice Brewster, that speaks to one of the questions that you asked Mr. Maddox, I think you said four times and couldn't get an answer, which is, what is the device if a trial court wishes to refuse this theory of a class action? The reason you can't get an answer is because the petitioners don't have an answer. Their understanding of how Section 18 is to be construed leaves them with a world in which there are no rules that would regulate an action.
Why don't the preponderance, superiority, and notice provisions apply just as they would in any case?
Well, Your Honor, because by the petitioner's reading of the statute, by definition, those requirements do not apply.
Well, I don't understand that, because A is clearly different from B. A says the court shall permit one or more members of the class to sue or be sued as follows. So that applies only if there's an individual representative. But B doesn't say that. It says an action may be maintained if A is met. Well, A wouldn't apply if there was not an individual representative. And in addition, and then you have all the rest of the requirements.
I think two problems with that reading the petition has posed, Your Honor. The first is that the prelude to B itself says an action can be maintained if the requirements of A are satisfied and the B elements are satisfied. Second, it misconceives what the statute is referring to when it says one or more members of the class in Section B. That is not in any sense a distinction between the Attorney General and a private litigant. That is nothing more than incorporating verbatim the text of Federal Rule 23, the Federal Class Action Rule, which all parties agreed was the purpose of the legislature when it enacted this statute. And if you lay this statute down beside Federal Rule 23, you'll see that language is nothing more than incorporating what the federal rule had said. And to suggest from that that the legislature intended implicitly to draw a distinction between an attorney general class action and a class action brought by an individual, and thereby to, in effect, create an exemption for the attorney general from all of the due process requirements that the court has recognized that are necessary in a settlement class action, would be a statutory construction that is simply untenable.
Well, I just don't see why they all have to be excluded. By the same token, if adequacy is a requirement, then essentially the Attorney General can't bring a class action.
I think that's not correct, Your Honor. I think that the Attorney General can bring a class action.
Except on behalf of state agencies. I mean, well, you can never bring a class action on behalf of the for damage to the policyholders or the insurance company.
It's not clear to me that that's true, Your Honor. If he has a class representative whose claims are adequate and typical and can satisfy the due process requirements of class action law, then he can bring a class action. And to the degree that a state subdivision has a proprietary interest that gives it standing to bring the claim, then he can bring a class action. The argument that's made here that you ought to absolve the Attorney General and give him an exemption from these due process elements simply because it might make it harder for him to bring the claim really runs counter to the last decade of this court's doctrine in class action law and what the U.S. Supreme Court
has said.
Well,
but we're also construing a legislative policy that seems to permit the AG to represent the state of Texas policyholders, consumers as a whole.
Well, that's right, Your Honor.
We're trying to reconcile those.
And we have to look at the entire statute in context because important to recall that Section 15, which is the classic provision that the Attorney General has used to enforce the statute, authorizes the Attorney General to sue in the name of the state in order to secure injunctive relief to enforce the statute, and that monetary relief can be afforded to, quote, identifiable persons in an injunctive action brought under that provision. The state did not need a class action in order to get the relief that it asserted.
Well, it may not, but the legislature gave it something.
Your Honor, the legislature...
Something more than what they had in Section 15.
That's right. The legislature gave it in Section 15 the power to bring the injunctive case and to secure restitution.
But this is not just piling on.
No, that's correct.
This is something else.
That's correct, Your Honor. But in the respect in which it piles on, it adds to the ability to bring the damage claim if the Attorney General can meet the requirements for a class action. There has been no instance in which the Attorney General has ever before tried to release the claims of individual citizens.
Yeah, let me ask you this. From your statement of facts, the procedural posturing, how did the Attorney General's office get involved here? I mean, does it matter that they, from what appears to me, hung on to your coattails and say, yeah, well, we know we want to get involved now, and we're going to intervene and settle this case? Does it matter if they initiated the action, or it doesn't matter? Or why is that important?
No, Your Honor,
is that the first thing that you put in your statement of facts?
I don't believe it matters who initiated the action. In fact, there were distinct actions, and the first actions filed that are implicated here were actions by policyholders Villanueva and Palladino that erased certain allegations. The state independently brought a Section 15 case for injunctive relief and restitution. That did not seek a class action, did not seek to have the power to release the claims of policyholders. There were then interventions that brought the actions together. Here is what's critically important. Until this settlement deal was struck between the state and farmers, there was no class action pleading. The record is truly uncontested that the state agreed to convert its case into a class action solely at the demand of farmers and solely for the purpose of allowing farmers to secure a release of the absent class members' claims.
Well, but that is a reason why this is not a superior way of proceeding. And it's a reason why the class shouldn't be certified or settled, but it is still awfully difficult to see why it is a reason that the Attorney General has to go find a private citizen to bring the action.
No, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. It is a reason why if the Attorney General wishes to convert his classic enforcement proceeding into a class action, he should be required to undergo the same rigorous scrutiny that this court requires of every other class action.
Well, I don't, but with respect to superiority and preponderance, I take your point. But with respect to adequacy of representation, I just don't understand why the trial court would have any interest in going through the Attorney General's office to make sure they were going to be able to represent their client.
Well, Your Honor, this falls into exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court has warned about in settlement classes generally and the importance of having a real class representative who can safeguard the due process interest that class action law is designed to accomplish. And if I may, I'll quote what Justice Ginsburg said about this problem in the Amchem case. She said, it's important to require strict compliance with all of these requirements, including adequacy of representation, in order to avoid an appraisal by a court of, quote, the chancellor's foot kind, which is a class certification dependent only on a court's gestalt judgment or overarching impression of the fairness of the settlement. And that, in essence, is what the Attorney General persuaded the trial court to do. Because the Attorney General says they are not required to bring forward a class representative against whom the adequacy and typicality determination can be made in the crucible of real judicial review, this supposed settlement class has been subjected to just that type of chancellor's foot analysis. Bloyette itself.
Well, it's not before us whether it was a good settlement or a good idea to release all
these
claims
or
not. We'll worry about that some other day. But I'm concerned if you got to get a private citizen. I mean, there's no question, regardless of the reality of how class actions actually work, there's no question as a legal matter. The class representative runs the case and makes the decisions, not the class counsel. That's the way it has to be, which means the Attorney General's got to obey whatever, you know, complaint, whoever the first or loudest people to complain were. And that is at least problematic.
Well, Your Honor, the premise that it's problematic assumes that that would in any way inhibit the Attorney General's lawful ability to enforce Article 21.
Well, I mean, what if the class representatives say, look, we don't care if all the insurers in Texas leave the state because it's not, we want our metal language, we want it now. Now, that's a problem.
Your Honor, again, it's a problem only.
We don't care about all those, we want my moldy house paid for. And I don't care that the rest of, you know, all the people with fine houses that may burn down next year ain't going to have any insurance. That's a problem.
It is a problem only if you believe the Attorney General needs the ability to litigate a class action in order to secure enforcement with the statute. Section 15 doesn't require that. It is only a problem.
But it allows it. 17 allows it.
17 allows you to bring
it. So it's no answer to say, well, he could do something else. He just, you know, we just ignore this one thing this legislature said he could do.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think it is an answer because the Attorney General has never before thought it important to try and litigate a class action under Section 17. This is the first time in 30 years the Attorney General ever suggested they needed this power. They bargained for it solely in order to be able to release
policy. Have all the home insurers ever threatened to leave the state before? Maybe it's the first time we need it.
Well, Your Honor, it may be the first time that anyone's ever thought of it. I would invite the court to ask Farmers Counsel when she argues what they'll think of this power the next time we have a crusading Attorney General in the Elliott Spitzer mold who says, I want to aggregate all of these private citizens' claims. I'm going to pursue these insurers to the fullest extent of the law. And I have a big stick now because I don't have to comply with the standard class action requirements. I respectfully suggest that is not the rule that ought to control class action litigation for any litigant in Texas, and it's not necessary to read Article 2121 to give that kind of an extraordinary power.
Can your clients opt out, pursue their claims individually?
Your Honor, they can opt out. And, yes, go ahead. Don't understand the court had another question.
So all the parties, the other two parties, agreed to the settlement, and we're here because your client's intervention.
That is correct, Your Honor. And two answers that are important there. Number one, the court consistently says that the ability of a party to opt out of a settlement does not absolve the need for rigorous scrutiny of the class certification elements. And second, it's not a surprise that Farmers and the Attorney General agreed to the settlement. It did not affect their interests at all. The Attorney General secured relief in this settlement that was fully supported by his pleadings under Section 15. The Deputy Assistant Attorney General, Jeff Boyd, who testified about the settlement negotiations, admitted the request for a release, the conversion to a class action and release, came up at the end of the settlement negotiations simply because Farmers wanted the ability to buy its piece on the absent policyholder claims. And the Attorney General, who was getting, in the benefit of the bargain, settlement of the state's claims, said, that's fine. I'll agree. He has no interest in the policyholder's claims. Look at what's released. There was a pending federal class action case on behalf of policyholders asserting violations of the Fair Credit Reporting Act at the time this settlement was negotiated. This settlement agreement on behalf of absent class members, not represented by the Attorney General, releases that claim.
But the Attorney General could have the right to bring this action, and those problems still be dealt with.
If the Attorney General had the right to bring this action, construing the statute to require a class representative, then you would have real judicial review as to whether that class representative was an adequate representative of the interests of the policyholders when compared to the claims that are being sacrificed. We haven't had any judicial
review. Now, there's some argument made in the briefs that the Attorney General himself is a class member, an adequate class member, to pursue this.
Well, he's certainly not a class member, and I don't believe the Attorney General will even suggest that he is. And the certification order makes clear there is no class representative. The Attorney General has appointed class counsel, but there is no class representative. And there is no way under the statute, as the Attorney General and the petitioner would read it, to impose any kind of scrutiny on the adequacy of
representation. But you could raise all your questions and an objection that he's not an adequate representative. In fact, you have.
Your Honor, we have argued on the alternative theory that the petitioner suggests that the statute can be construed in this manner. We have argued that in that instance that the Attorney General's representation is not adequate. But I point out that that assumption, the way they read the statute, depends on capturing the adequacy determination that is in the statutory provision for review of an ultimate approval of the fairness of the settlement. And that runs directly in the face of what the court said in Cortez, that fairness of the settlement is no substitute for rigorous adherence to the class certification requirements. And the point is, they have to gerrymander the statute. They have to pick and choose certain elements of Section 18 that they find attractive, but not others, in order to make this distinction work.
If A applied, you could, trial court could ask the Attorney General about your claim to find out if the claims being prosecuted by the Attorney General are typical of the class's claims, and whether the Attorney General is going to adequately represent those claims, even if there was no class representative, couldn't you?
Are you asking in theory, Your Honor, right, or under
just,
the statute?
Just in theory. In theory, one could.
I think, Your Honor, that kind of an analysis, while it could theoretically be made, runs contrary to the very premise of judicial review that you need a particular ripe litigant against whom these issues can be tested. And again, Justice Ben
talks about this. That's a standing question. There's no question the legislature gave the Attorney General standing.
Standing to prosecute the injunctive action. That's right. And standing to bring a class action with a real class representative.
No, that's not in the statute, is it?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree.
Show me the words where it says that the Attorney General can bring a class action with a named representative.
Your Honor, Section A says the Attorney General may bring a class action. Section B says here are the elements required of a class action. Class action is a term of art in American law that is uniformly understood to require a class representative. This court in Novak, at the urging of Attorney General Cornyn, said the essential premise of every class action is a class representative with standing to sue. If you try and engage in adequacy or typicality analysis in the abstract without a real litigant, you lose the crucible of review that's the heart of this due process test. And that's exactly what AmChem talks about, and it's what Bloyd talks about.
We're running out of time. What would be unconstitutional in your I didn't really follow your unconstitutional argument. It was very. What would be unconstitutional about saying the Attorney General can bring this, and we'll look at the kinds of claims he's bringing to see, or she's bringing to see, if they're typical, adequate, et cetera. What would be unconstitutional?
Your Honor, succinctly stated, we read AmChem and Ortiz to require an actual class representative for whom adequacy and typicality can be viewed in the particular prism of a particular claim as due process requirements. The U.S. Supreme Court has never indicated that there is any exception to that requirement for a public official, and to hold the contrary on this statute would offend the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. There are no further questions?
Even if the class members had a right to opt out?
Yes, Your Honor, because it is well settled that the right to opt out does not absolve the court of the need for rigorous scrutiny of class certification requirements in every case.
Just a second. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Ms. Marcy Greer will present the rebuttal for the petition.
If I may, I'd like to go back to Justice Medina's question about the distinction between parens patriae and the statutory authority in Section 17. Because if we have led this Court to believe that the authority is in any way dependent upon common law doctrine, then we are remiss. This is a purely statutory cause of action. The whole purpose of our parens patriae historical context is to show the problem that the Supreme Court identified in Hawaii and was discussed in Frito-Lay that could only be fixed by legislative response. And the role of the Texas Attorney General, first Crawford Martin, being an amicus party in Hawaii, and then John Hill, his successor, in going to the Texas legislature and saying, we have a problem. We need enforcement authority. We need better ways for us to be able to vindicate
the
laws.
Attorney General's office said they're bringing both the parens patriae and the class action.
I don't think
they can do both or just one.
They're not seeking to bring a common law parens patriae. They were seeking the statutory authority to fill in the two gaps missing at common law. One being that under common law, you've got to show quasi.
But so would you agree that parens patriae is merely used as an adjective? Are you using it merely as an adjective to describe the kind of class action attorney generals can bring?
Absolutely. And perhaps public class action would have been a more appropriate term. As we've dealt into
I can
into
pronounce that.
Do you agree
Fair
with
enough.
I'm unclear about whether you think the preponderance and superiority and notice and other provisions of old Section 18 apply?
Yes, sir, I do. I think they apply very, very clearly, and that
And do you
provides
think that the troublesome aspects of preclusive effects of the judgment can be fully evaluated under those rights?
I do, Your Honor, and here's why. Because the predominance inquiry effectively takes care of commonality. This Court talks about that all the time. You can't get to predominance unless you have common questions. The TDI has to make that determination in requesting the class action. So that is fulfilled. And then, of course, there's some discussion about conflicts of interest.
You can get around that. I mean, there's four different types maintainable. Predominance is one of them. You all have hundreds of suits by individual policyholders, right?
Absolutely.
All of them make 2121 insurance code violations in them, right?
They do.
And so what? When the Attorney General, this one or a future one, starts intervening on all those and saying this is a class action of one because you have opposed or acted on a ground generally applicable to this class, which is one person, the plaintiff, how are you going to kick them out?
Well, the way I would do it is to suggest that the TDI has abused its administrative discretion in bringing this as a class action. If there's only one member, then a class action is not the appropriate vehicle under Section 17.
Why? If 18A doesn't apply, why is a class action of one ruled out?
Because the common issues will not predominate amongst...
That's only one of the four maintainable grounds. There's three others. I wanted the Attorney General bring the class action to one for an injunction. It doesn't matter about commonality and predominance.
Well, you're focusing on the numerosity requirement more than commonality. And the numerosity requirement is presumptively in play whenever you use the term class action. There would be no reason to...
So parts of 18A really do apply to the Attorney General.
I think inherently, to the extent they're carried through in terms of predominance and superiority, by definition, a class device would not be superior if there's only one member. It just makes no sense. So, and I think I want to focus in on where I think the Court of Appeals really missed.
Speaking of the Court of Appeals, in Justice Spurrier's opinion, he concluded that the AG could not represent the class action because the state had not suffered a similar injury.
That's correct. Or if he recruited an individual to serve as traditional class representative.
And because AG's representation wasn't adequate to address that.
Well, it wasn't could not, as a matter of law, be adequate without the identifiable class representative, the private policyholder. And where the analysis goes wrong is in starting with Section 18, because this is an authority to an agency question. This court has written legions of opinions about how that works. You look to the statute that grants the authority. That's Section 17. Section 17 is clear standing alone. It's an either-or statute. There is a disjunctive word in there that's purposefully put. Either TDI requests the Attorney General to bring it, or a private party standing in the shoes of himself and others similarly situated brings the class action. See, the presumption that the Court of Appeals operated under, and you're hearing from the interveners, is that there exists, like some platonic form, a true form of class action, and that all other statutes and rules are designed to emulate that in its perfect sense. That's not the case. You know, Section 18 is absolutely adopted almost verbatim from Rule 43 of the federal rules. We know that. That's clear from the statute and the statutory history. But there is no Section 17 analog in the federal rules. It has to mean something more than you can bring a class action. It's there for a purpose, and that's where the authority lies. 18 carries with it no grant of authority. So you can't start there to define the court's power. So the whole way that the Court of Appeals has framed the issue, look at the very first line of its opinion. It says, whether the statute permits the Attorney General, TDI, to bring this lawsuit without complying with Section 18. That is putting the statutory analysis exactly backwards. And I think the regulatory context in which the statute was passed is absolutely critical to understand. These are not personal injury common law rights that are vested as Shoza's in action, like Amkin, like Novak, like Ortiz. That is a completely different paradigm. These are statutory powers to enforce the insurance laws of this state.
So they would be exempted from all of the other rigorous requirements that private class actions would be required?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think there's a lot of accountability built into the statute as written by the legislature. You start with there has to be an individual aggrieved by a Section 4 violation.
Yeah, but it seems with your argument that you can pick and choose which ones you want to adhere to. And if it doesn't fit your case, and you can exclude it because the statute, under your theory, gives you broad power, or the Attorney General broad power, to do as he or she pleases.
I'm not advocating that, Your Honor, certainly not as a regulated entity, but I would say that the problem with the Court of Appeals' opinion is that it makes it harder for TDI, who is the centerpiece of the regulatory scheme in this state, to bring a class action to vindicate the insurance code. Than for a private citizen who just happens to be a policyholder.
They say it's unconstitutional. I'm wondering, of course, I know tobacco cases don't come under the insurance code, but assume they did. And so the Attorney General, you know, the thing that beats tobacco cases all the time is you knew the risk and you smoked anyway. Can the Attorney General then bring class action against, if it was your client, and say, I don't need any class representatives, and you can't say I chose to smoke because I'm the Attorney General, I didn't. That would be a bit of a due process problem.
Absolutely, but there are two reasons why that's a very different paradigm. One, those are common law personal injury claims, and two, there's no statutory authority for the Attorney General to bring them.
So we've got statutory authority here that also allows the policyholders to get mental anguish and stuff like that. Attorney General's just not going to be able to make a credible claim for mental anguish. Is he or she?
He had those claims before him in the Section 15 lawsuit that he brought. He is bringing regulatory claims to stop the alleged practices under the code, and as part of the remedial relief to make everybody whole, he has the authority to get those claims back. If I could just briefly, I want to mention one thing about the procedural history of this case because I think there's a misperception. The Palomino lawsuit is the only homeowner's lawsuit that was on file before the Attorney General's suit. It was limited to a single practice called credit scoring, and after the lawsuit was filed, nothing happened. It was not until after settlement that that lawsuit was amended to match the huge constellation of claims brought by TDI and the Attorney General in four or five different administrative and judicial proceedings. So I think there's a misperception about who came first and the extent. And we need the authority to be able to rely upon our ability to deal with TDI as the regulator for rate-making practices, which is
further,
what this is about.
Further questions? If not, thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.